welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also regularly features Emma Burnell, a Labour blogger. Good evening, Emma.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, and tonight we've got a special guest. We have Darian Graham-Smith, who we've invited on to talk to us tonight about various issues. Good evening, Darian.
Hello there.
Darian is technical editor of PC Pro magazine. I'm a regular listener to their podcast and can heartily recommend it. But Darian isn't here speaking in his capacity as technical editor of PC Pro, so he's not speaking for his magazine. He's just here in his own capacity. And one of the issues we're going to talk about is one that I think is a little bit close to his heart and his kind of interest, the draft communications bill, which we'll come on to first, actually. So my understanding of what's happened this week is that on Tuesday, a report was issued, which was a joint parliamentary committee report. And it's been pretty damning about the communications bill that's currently going through Parliament, which is set to basically increase the security services' ability to be able to, probably no nice way of putting this, spy on us, spy on our communications and be able to work out who is trying to communicate with who, I think is one of the key things. Darian, what's your understanding of kind of what's happened with this week and maybe what the response has been to it?
Well, of course, it's always a contentious issue whenever you talk about any kind of surveillance. People are always very, very wary of any kind of increase in the powers that be's ability to find out basically what you're doing online and who you're talking to on your mobile phone, etc., etc. What's always very difficult, though, is to actually cut through the very emotive responses that people have as soon as these issues come up, and to try to get to the reality of, first of all, what's needed and what's actually been requested, and then what's actually being proposed, because I had a quick look at the report that came out myself, and it runs to 326 paragraphs along with a lot of appendices, and I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to tell you I read them all, because I haven't, and I bet you that a lot of the people who've been complaining out in the blogosphere haven't either. I wouldn't like to suggest that the parliamentarians who've been criticising this, I'm sure they've done very diligent work. But yeah, I think that the debate in the public sphere, you know, to draw a horrible generalisation, it normally is quite ill-informed. So the first thing I think to do is to try to cut through that as much as possible and get to the reality.
Mm. So in terms of the reality then, I mean, my understanding is that they want to increase the scope of the type of communications that can be intercepted by security services. So they already have the ability to intercept things like phone calls. I mean, they've obviously been around for a long time. But newer types of communication, like voice over IP services such as Skype, there's still a problem whereby they can't really do what they want to do with that. Is that your understanding?
It seems that way. I mean, from what I've taken away from the debate and what I've read about this, it seems, on the face of it, some probably very well-intentioned person has sat down and tried to extend the sorts of surveillance that we've already had and that people haven't, so far as I'm aware, been, you know, protesting up and down Whitehall against, just to try to extend similar sort of measures to emerging technologies which aren't covered by existing regulations.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems, my understanding of this is, because there's been some fairly heated debates internally within the Lib Dems, within the party, and I mean, there was a fairly infamous conference call that was held with a number of bloggers a few months ago that I was on. I was fairly quiet on the call, actually, but some of the bloggers weren't so quiet, and some of the bloggers weren't so quiet afterwards as well. There were some people wrote about it, which other people thought shouldn't have happened, and it should have been kept private. But, you know,
if you're going to have a conference call with bloggers, what do you expect?
Well, I think that's a pretty fair point, to be honest, Darian.
They are bloggers complaining about their lack of privacy, so.
Indeed, yeah, somewhat ironic. But it was reported, and it was written about. And, I mean, the tone of the call was along the lines of, I mean, really, it was along the lines of the sort of stuff that Theresa May's been coming out with. You know, we need it to protect us against paedophiles and terrorists. And that kind of knee-jerk reaction and fairly, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you hear from politicians who are very authoritarian and who want powers to collect with the security services. But there was a pretty heated discussion as well about how you're supposed to separate out content from routing information. So something like Skype, because of the way it works technically, unlike with a phone call where you can say, okay, well, such and such a person is calling such and such a person, and you can see the number from and the number to. And whilst you're doing that, you have no idea what the content of the call was. In the case of Skype, it's not really possible to separate those things out because the content of the call is all wrapped up with the routing information about the call. So I suppose you could have some very clever technical solution whereby the routing information is stripped out of that and presented separately, but they still need access to the thing that has all the content as well. And you're then trusting that they won't peek at what's in the content as well as the routing information. And that seemed to be a real point of contention on this. I wonder what we think about that.
Just, Darren, I think you're probably much better placed than me to answer any technical questions. But I did just want to come back to sort of slightly earlier what you were saying, because I think there is a lot of language that is not necessarily helpful, a lot of heat and very little light sometimes when it comes to this kind of discussion. And I don't come from the same place as you, Mark, necessarily. I'm fairly liberal, but I'm also, you know, I want to balance the ability for the police forces to do their best job with the rights and of citizens to live in privacy. And I think that sometimes during these debates, we become so caught up in a discussion that happens above reality and above people's heads and is about idealism, is not necessarily rooted in the reality of day-to-day combating of crimes. So what my concern with this kind of thing generally is that a large-scale technical solution is presented. And, for example, like with ID cards, I could see fairly quickly they wouldn't do the job they were supposed to do. So what I would like to know, Darren, if you could maybe speak as a kind of expert on this, would it work? Would the stuff they're proposing lead to a situation, in your opinion, that would catch more criminals?
I think technically it is certainly possible if you have more raw data to sift through, more things that you can set your searches against available. You might be able to catch the thing that trips up the guy you know is a criminal, or you might be able to pick up the chatter at an earlier stage. I don't think it's a fantasy that could help. But you have to understand that, you know, it's a very good thing that we're having this kind of debate and this kind of discussion in the open. But the criminals can see us having it, and they're probably not going to be foolish enough to use their regular contract mobile phone to make phone calls back and forth to their mates about their terrorist plots. So I think there is a degree of kind of optimism about how far surveillance and how far these kinds of measures can take us. And the alternative is, of course, to do it all in the dark, or sort of cloak and dagger, as I've sometimes seen suggested, but obviously never proven, that the US intelligence services do. And of course, that really does raise all sorts of troubling questions. But if you want, I mean, to be brutal, if you want to solve crimes, that's a better way of getting the information. Do it, you know, somewhere where it's not visible and not known to the people you're spying on.
Well, I think you've raised quite an interesting point there, Darian, because surely the people who want to do bad stuff are going to be very careful about how they communicate with each other. So the idea that they're just going to go on an unencrypted Skype call and, you know, give away all their plans is pretty unrealistic, isn't it? I mean, it is far more likely that they're going to use, you know...
Yeah, well, it's the question of...
Encrypted lines and whatever. I mean, I don't even know the details about the kind of cryptography that can be used for these things. But even at a very basic level, I know that one of the things that I've seen reported that sometimes people do is that they'll draft an email with some like webmail account, and then the other person has access to that same webmail account, and they'll just go in and read the draft, so it never even has to get sent.
That's clever. But I mean, it's a question of degree, I guess, because not every criminal is a super genius, and I guess
do they not all live in like hollowed out volcanoes and stuff?
I think the ones who can afford that are. Seriously, I mean, it really is a question of degree. If you do a very, very light amount of surveillance, you will catch the people who are so stupid or unfortunate that they're you know, effectively plotting in the open air. And it's just a case of how far you want to drill down. I mean, something which everyone takes as a given is that we have a right to some kind of privacy. But as long as we have some kind of privacy, that means we have some kind of ability to conspire.
Yeah. One of the things that I found a bit heartening this week is that Nick Clegg has come out and said that he thinks that this needs a fundamental rethink. And the briefings, the murmurings that I'm hearing are that it's not going to go through in anything like its current form. So this isn't one of these committees that is going to report and then just be completely ignored. Like, for example, the Commission on Drugs, which we predicted what was going to happen last week and then found out they weren't going to do anything about it. Although, again, Clegg made his view clear on that. Yeah, you did tell me that, Emma. But again, Clegg set out his stall on that too. But on this one, I think they are adamant that this has to be changed quite fundamentally. But even Clegg conceded that changes are needed. He does recognise. And I think his point man on this has been Julian Huppert. I know he's done a lot of work behind the scenes. He's a Lib Dem MP for Cambridge, who's very good on technical stuff.
No, I'm familiar with Julian Huppert. I have a lot of friends still back in Cambridge, and I've heard nothing but good things about him as a constituency MP and as somebody who sort of votes according to what you might call evidence-based reasons rather than perhaps emotive or political ones. So although I have no political it's not true. I have a political affiliation myself. I'm a member of the Pirate Party, but I don't think that will necessarily inform this discussion
you
very
are
much.
First pirate, how exciting.
That is fantastic, because we're trying to get a diverse range of guests on this podcast, and I didn't even know that until you
I'm
just
not
said
an
that,
active so. I'm not an activist,
you're an
let's
active
say
pirate.
No, I'm a very passive pirate. I might sit there and click on the newsletter and go, yes, I support that, but that's about the extent of my activism. I'm not sure it would be compatible with my role at PC Pro if I were to start cheerleading for that particular side. But where was I? Oh, yes, Julian Huppert, yes. And he's obviously coming in with, an evidence-based approach. And you mentioned Theresa May, and I believe was it in The Sun where she had a leader last week, which was basically saying, as you say, we need surveillance to stop the paedophiles and terrorists. And there was a photograph, I mentioned this on the PC Pro podcast, it was illustrated with a photograph of the blown apart bus from the 7th of July 2005. And it was all very much an appeal to emotion. And it's quite sort of heartening in a way to see, obviously this is how the structure should work, that we can have these big statements and then they come under scrutiny.
Not the Tory conference we've just had, but the one before where she said something like, and I'm not making this up, you get to stay in the country if you've got a cat. It turned out she was making it up.
Yeah, it's that classic Richard Littlejohn thing, isn't it? You couldn't make it up, when actually after time he is making it up. I am very shocked to hear an article in The Sun appealing to emotion. I'm not sure that's ever happened.
Well, you know, I want to stick up just a little bit for Theresa May in that I think that was the right tone to take for that medium to reach that section of society. I don't mean to insult Sun readers. I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm just saying you pick up The Sun for a nice, simple, digestible read, and you don't buy it because you want a balanced, proper dissection of the issues. So I think that was, I kind of see what she was doing, and I can't say it was in itself the wrong thing to do, though I may disagree with, with the motives behind doing it.
Politically, it was absolutely the right thing to do if what she
politically,
wants
that's
is,
the word, yeah.
is pass this bill. Absolutely, and she'll get popular support, and the Tories could do with a bit more popular support from The Sun right now, because they've not had that much over the last year. But yeah, it's not what you'd call evidence-based.
No, and I agree with you, Darian. I am quite heartened that we are seeing some, on this issue, for example, we're seeing evidence that the parliamentary system is working the way it should. So there's a fairly badly drafted bill going through Parliament, and the committee's come along and said, this isn't good enough, you need to go away and do it again. And that is what should happen, and I think it does show the value of having that level of scrutiny. I just hope that when it comes back, it's not just the same thing with a slightly different set of clothes.
Yeah, this is just another political pause.
When we talk about the system working as it should, actually, I have to say the last time I paid quite so much attention to a parliamentary bill was the digital economy bill, as it then was. Yeah, I know. And I sat and I actually watched the debate and I thought, this guy's making some good points. This guy's making some stupid points. Oh, I don't know which way it's going to go, but fingers crossed. And then it came to the vote. And of course, dozens of MPs who hadn't even listened just trooped in and voted the way they'd been whipped. Pointless.
Welcome to politics. Yeah, I followed that fairly closely as well. And it was actually what happened. The reason why it was it was handled so badly is because it was done in the wash-up period in the last couple of weeks before the general election. They just needed to push it through. So in the end, it was a real dog's breakfast. And I think it's fallen apart at the seams as they've tried to actually implement it as a law since. So hopefully they'll learn some lessons.
Well, the most heartening thing I heard about that was it was one of the Lords, I forget who said, this is a bad bill, but it would be better to pass it and then fix it than to reject the whole thing and have it the next Parliament start and have to start again from scratch.
Possibly, but it doesn't say much about how they've managed to get to that point, really, does it? You shouldn't really be passing a really bad bill and then fixing
it. No, but that was the most positive thing I've said. So.
You're obviously a glass half full type guy, don't
you? Well, you know, there's entertainment all around. What else can you possibly say when things like this happen?
Okay. Emma, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about gay marriage.
Well, yeah, given we've just been talking about the whipping system, I think it might be an interesting time to do it. I thought that your party were going to shame mine to bits this week, Mark, and you dropped the ball.
Did I? I don't remember holding the ball.
Basically, when Labour announced, or it leaked out, that Labour were not going to whip the gay marriage vote, calling it an issue of conscience when quite a large and very vocal group within my party would say it's not an issue of conscience, it's an issue of equality. And so we decided not to whip for whatever reason. And I got I wrote a very angry blog about it saying, as a straight woman, I think it's really important that I stand up and say that this is ridiculous. And I got lots of, Julian Huppert, for example, was one of the people who retweeted my tweet about that and within that blog, I said the Lib Dems absolutely have a chance to slaughter Labour on this issue, to reopen the eyes of some of the people they might have lost. If they whip this vote, they will be morally superior on this issue. And I thought, if I were the Lib Dems, you know, it's just insane not to now. And then, yeah, lo and behold, Alistair Carmichael turned around the next day and didn't whip it. And I just thought, you idiots.
Yeah, I'd read that post, actually. It was a good, well-argued blog post, and nice picture of your wedding day as well, if I recall correctly.
I never miss a chance, because I had a lot of money spent on me that day, so I'm going to get the best out of those photographs.
Well, it's good for me to see, because I was only invited to the evening do, not the main daytime do, so, you know, obviously I need to see those pictures from the daytime. But but to be fair, I only kind of vaguely knew. I was amazed he's invited me to the evening do. No, I think that might have been the first time I ever met you. So just for people who don't know, me and Emma have known each other for many years virtually, because we both used to post quite frequently on a forum that was more focused really around kind of television and music and comedy and stuff, really, wasn't it?
Indeed. But
we still post there occasionally. I won't mention it, because I don't want people going and pulling out my old posts from there when I didn't self-edit very much. I mean, in terms of dropping the ball, it's a difficult one, because Lib Dems are supposed to be liberal. And whipping people on an issue that many people feel is a conscience issue could be considered quite illiberal. And I suppose they're on a bit of a horns of a dilemma. What I was hoping was that all the Lib Dem MPs would vote for the bill, and therefore it would be a win-win, because they'd been allowed to vote the way they wanted, and they all wanted to vote the way that I wanted them to vote. Actually, I don't think that's going to happen. I think, is it Gordon Birtwistle?
Yeah, possibly John
I don't
Hemming
think he's going
to
vote for it. Yeah, so I don't think we're going to have a 100%
also,
record on that.
Also, I have to say, I thought Simon Hughes's, there is not a fence that man cannot find to straddle. I mean, his intervention on the day was absolutely disgraceful. What you had was, what felt like hundreds, was in fact dozens of Tory MPs standing up and making really quite disgusting speeches. I mean, speeches that were not very much what Darian might call emotional rather than evidence-based. And just over and over again. So it started to feel like a real grind. I mean, really, really quite horrible. And I'm not gay, but if I were, I might feel really, really just so victimised listening to that. And then I just thought, you know, given the torrent that had come through, for Simon Hughes, you know, a Liberal MP, to stand up and go, well, on the one hand, you know, there is a lot of concern about this bill, and people have every right to be as concerned as they want to be. I thought, don't stand up and say that message. You don't need to support that side right now. That side is having their issues very well aired. Don't straddle the fence on this one. If you feel that way, and you have a kind of on the one, six of the one, half a dozen of the other attitude, don't say anything. It felt disappointing.
Yeah. What do you think about this?
Well, and it's quite fascinating for me hearing you. Obviously, you guys are much more political animals than I am. My own view, and I believe this is shared by a lot of, you know, my peers. I wouldn't say I speak for, you know, the great masses of the people at large. But my own view, and I'm sure it's not just mine, is you should never whip anything. Whipping is just completely overriding the constituents who have elected the MP. And I cannot personally, I'm sure it happens for good and sensible and necessary reasons from time to time. But a vote like this, for example, which is a question of conscience and it is a question of equality. And so why the hell would you need Labour to be whipped to vote the quote right way according to its own principles? I to be honest, I mean, as soon as I hear someone say, I want this to be a whipped vote, I was hoping it would be whipped, then I'm sorry, that kind of puts my back up, because you know, the MP is elected to represent the people, not to do as he's told.
Well, yes and no. The MP is elected on a manifesto, which he's then supposed to stick to. And we did have a marriage commitment. It wasn't as clearly written as it could have been in our manifesto. But not wanting a whip to exist is a perfectly legitimate position, which I myself used to hold and I no longer do. But what bothers me, what happens is, it's fine and it's never even discussed on practically every other issue. Issues like the NHS, or issues like tuition fees, or issues like the digital economy bills, to try and be unpartisan about it. And you know, there were good Labour MPs who did vote against the whip on the digital economy bill, but it was a whipped vote. Either you make that decision not to have the whip or system altogether, and you know, it's then not an issue around a vote like this, or you don't, in which case this vote should be whipped.
I mean, I think to pick up the broader point from you there, Darian, it is an interesting question. And I this is one of the reasons I like getting guests on, because you're kind of challenging the fundamental basis of what we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, sorry.
it's good, because I remember years ago having a fairly detailed debate with a good friend of mine who really isn't into politics at all. And he was basically asking, why do we have politics at all? And it was, I couldn't really answer the question. I think I know a little bit more now to be able to engage with that a bit more. But at the time, I was a bit like, because he was basically questioning the whole point and the basis of politics. And he wasn't doing it from, you know, what's the point of politics? He was saying, why is it evolved like this? Why do we have parties? Why can't we just have someone like Richard Branson, who's, you know, gets the franchise to run the UK for 20 years? And, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why it wouldn't work. And I did argue with him, but it really made me think. And asking about why do we have the whipping system? I mean, it is kind of what Emma said, that, you know, you have parties and they're elected on a particular manifesto.
Well, yeah, but you vote for an individual. You don't vote for a party, and people think you do.
But some people.
I don't think most individual MPs would be elected without the party behind them.
I'm sorry, by the way, to drag this away from gay marriage. I assume we're all actually broadly in agreement on that particular issue. So I think we can talk about the mechanics of how the vote will proceed rather than that. Maybe I'm coming at this from a slightly unusual angle, because here in Islington, our MP is Jeremy Corbyn. I'm sure you've come across his name, possibly the gentleman himself. He's very active. He's very out there. And he was a real thorn in the side, as far as I could make out, of the last Labour government. He very much voted with his conscience and certainly did not do, you know, what he was told from on high. And we love that. We are very, very happy to have that. And we sort of say to other people, we're sorry to hear that in your constituency, the MP is clearly, just doing what's been decided in number 10 or wherever. But maybe this is an unusual place and it doesn't work like that for everyone.
You certainly have an unusual character in Jeremy, but even with Jeremy, he will have sat down with his colleagues within his part of the party, the LRC, I think it is, Labour Reform Committee, who are the sort of core hard left MPs. And they'll have talked amongst themselves and they have come to an agreed course of action. So it's not, they're not officially whipped, but they are within themselves acting as a collective.
I mean, I think if you take this to its logical conclusion, and if you say that we shouldn't have a whipping system and MPs should be able to just vote however they want on any individual issue, I mean, first of all, it would be very difficult to get any kind of legislative programme through the House of Commons, because you'd never have any idea whether you would have a majority for a particular bill or at least it would be very difficult to work in that way. And I think the other problem is that how would people know what they were voting for? I mean, I understand what you're saying, that you vote for an individual, and if we had a perfectly informed electorate,
fully
researched before they cast their ballot, in every single case, then you could say fine, and then you'd know what you were getting. But in reality, that doesn't happen. I think a lot of time, people don't do that, and if they vote in Labour, they're voting Labour because they maybe like the leader or like a couple of the policies that they've seen on the news, or even for other reasons. And the idea that all these MPs have individual mandates to do whatever they want. So I think the House of Commons can sustain a number of mavericks, but I think if they were all mavericks, I think it would just be completely unmanageable and you'd have no idea what you were getting, and I think it would collapse under the weight of its own incoherence.
Well, maybe. I'm sorry I kind of dragged us down this very tangential path. To bring it sort of slightly back, one thing that struck me, Emma was mentioning the Conservatives, who said some things which, frankly, I don't find very pleasant to listen to either. And it sort of surprised me. I suppose David Cameron's in a rather unusual position, because many of the things he said have been, considering the party that he's leading, impressively forward-thinking, I would say. And it just sort of surprises us to hear from the same benches what to us sounds some very backwards things coming at the same time.
Yeah,
I agree. I think Cameron's been very impressive on this issue. But I think what he's done is he's picked, I think he almost sees this as his equivalent of Clause 4. I think he sees this as an iconic issue that he can use to demonstrate that him and... Yeah,
no, I think he's actually proved that's changed.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think that's exactly right. No, it's fine. But I think that's why he's doing it. But I think it's very striking that on another issue, I mean, sorry to go back to it, but on drugs, when 10 years ago, David Cameron was actually on the Home Affairs Select Committee that reported in 2002 that also recommended what the recent report has recommended, which is a Royal Commission, and essentially it's code for decriminalising at least cannabis and maybe a few other drugs at the softer end of the scale. And yet he's chosen to go to the wall and stand by the current regime on that. So I think he's trying to pick his battles, and he's picked this one and he's decided to stick with it. But I do feel that there's a certain level of inconsistency in that he's decided this is the one. And yet when it comes to other issues that perhaps people who also believe in gay marriage would also want to see happen,
something that my girlfriend always says, which I think rings very true, this is a perfect example of it, is that always being the leader of the Conservative Party is managing a coalition, even when you're just talking within the party.
I think that's true of probably all parties.
Well, yes, I suppose that's true, yes. It's really
party,
glaring with
any
the
party that's
more
than two MPs is a coalition. The Greens are probably all right.
Yeah, it's probably not true of the Pirate Party yet, but give it time. Okay, so we thought we also might talk about the aftermath of the school shooting in Connecticut, where I think it's 26 people were killed, 20 of whom were very young children, aged between 5 and 10. It's obviously an horrific story. And the aftermath of that is now people are talking about the potential for gun control in the US. I actually did a short blog post about this today. I mean, my take on it, I didn't really talk too much about the shooting itself, but it was more about how I think it was President Obama's spokesperson who actually said now is not the right time to be talking about gun control. Well, I pointed out, I went onto Wikipedia and I had a look, and there's been 16 mass shootings in the US this year, so that's more than one a month.
I thought that he actually said something a bit different, which has quite a different meaning, which is now is not the right time to be talking about gun control. Yesterday was the right time to be talking about gun control.
Well, he said, the quote that I read was, now is not the right time. He said there will be another time to talk about this, and we should, but now is not the right time. And my problem, I have two problems with that. The first one is that this only ever gets raised straight after a shooting. Mm-hmm. And then once the media moves on, once the people who've been murdered have been buried, then the news agenda moves on and it doesn't refocus on this until the next shooting. And then people say it's not the right time to be talking about this again. The other problem is there are so many of them that actually, if you wanted a clear, 6 months, however long it's going to take, or a year, to get some legislation in place, get it debated and get it refined and get it right, get it based on the evidence, there's going to be more shootings in the meantime. And therefore, people are going to say this isn't the right time to be talking about this. I just think it's, if they want to talk about it and they want to do something about it, they need to just do it and not think about, is it too close to the last shoot?
The trouble is, though, I mean, you can't, as Europeans, we can't talk to Americans on equal terms about this, because they come at it from such a different set of axioms and assumptions that I think, you know, I don't mean this arrogantly. I think it is insulting for us to go to them and say, this is what you should do. You should do what we've done. And that makes it very difficult for us to have any kind of meaningful part in that dialogue, which is very frustrating, because statements such as, this is not the time to talk about gun control. I was just quietly Googling while you were talking, actually. I can't find Obama saying that, but Mitt Romney definitely said it during the past year about the shooting at the screening of The Dark Knight Rises in Aurora in Colorado. He said that then. It seems to be a phrase which echoes after, and it's sad that we have to say this, after every mass shooting that occurs in the US. But it's a real fundamental, I mean, it's not just a, you know, a simple legislative matter that someone could, if they wanted, sit down and fix in a matter of weeks or months. It really does go to the heart of not just drafting a constitutional amendment for them, but then getting kind of the mass of public opinion to support it. I think it might be a two-thirds majority that's needed to amend the constitution there. Would be a gargantuan task that would really require Americans to rethink, you know, their entire relationship with society, because they think of themselves, obviously their right to guns is an expression of individuality. And one thing I see over and over again on forums when I get involved in gun control debates, which I do far more often than is remotely sensible, is that the whole point of our carrying guns is because it means that we can fight back against the government. Now, to me, that sounds absolutely laughable. I mean, the US government is an enormous and incredibly rich machine, which happens to have access to the world's largest military by an enormous margin. So the idea that, you know, somebody in their home in Virginia could stockpile a couple of rifles and that would keep them safe if the government really wanted to go and take their home or do whatever it is that's assumed to be, you know, the government's ultimate agenda. To me, that seems ridiculous, but to them it's symbolic, it's semiotic, it's the way they define themselves. And so it's frustrating to admit it, but we can't really, as Europeans, I think, fully grasp and dig into everything that has to happen for these tragedies to stop in the way that we anticipate that they might be stopped.
I think you're right. I mean, yeah, American culture will have to massively, massively change, and you don't do that overnight. And I'm not even sure there is the currently, whether there ever will be, the will to change that culture. I think what struck me was there seems to have been, over the last couple of days, there's not just been the now's not the right time to talk about gun control, but equally there's been a, it's not about gun control, it's about mental health care. It's not about mental health care, it's about video games. It's not about video games, it's about school safety. As if there's one trigger, there's one issue that will be the magic thing that will solve everything, rather than looking at all the different elements that might lead to some of these tragedies taking place.
You know, I do agree, actually, 100% with that. I've been talking as if the solution is simply to get the guns off the street and the rest will fall into place. Not only is that obviously an extremely difficult thing to do, but as has been pointed out to me, there's no guarantee that that would actually help. If you look up statistics, which are readily available online, as to, you know, your likelihood of being shot with a legal or illegal gun, then actually the availability of guns doesn't really seem to be much of a marker. And it's been pointed out to me by some pro-gun debaters that I think Switzerland and certainly some European countries have more firearms per capita than certain states in the US do, but have like far, far lower homicide rates. So obviously it's not just people seeing guns, having guns, and therefore using guns. There is some deeper reason why having 10 guns in Switzerland doesn't mean you're going to shoot somebody. Having 10 guns in California, well, quote, does. Obviously it doesn't.
Yeah,
I can heartily recommend actually an article that I read on Huffington Post earlier today, which is titled "I Am
brilliant,
Adam Lanza's Mother."
Piece.
Yeah, I just for people who don't know, Adam Lanza is the name of the 20-year-old man who did the shooting in Connecticut on Friday. But this post is from a mother of another 13. Child who's I think only 13 at the moment, but who has a lot of behavioural problems and has threatened her and has threatened her other two children, and she keeps having to take him to psychiatric hospitals. but the help just isn't there, and there's not really anything they can do. And I think her fear is that one day something terrible might happen at the hands of her son. And I think it really does just tie in with what you've both just said, that this is a much more complicated issue. I do also agree with you, Darian. It's very easy for us to sit here and preach about what needs to happen. It almost reminds me a little bit of what happened during the 2008 election, when I think there were a lot of articles particularly targeted at voters in Ohio, actually, trying to convince them to not vote for George Bush because it was really important that they
that
shouldn't do that.
And
I think
that
just
election.
Oh, that wasn't the Guardian, was it?
Mark
getting
County
people
Guardian.
To...
Yeah.
Yes. Oh.
That's right, yeah. And it just pissed Americans off. There were Ohioans who voted for George Bush out of spite. They actually stated as much because, you know, these limeys were trying to tell them what to do, and it didn't go down very well at all. Yeah, of course it was 2004, sorry. I'm forgetting my dates. Yeah, so I agree. But at the same time, I think it's a legitimate subject for us to talk about because, well, you know, in this country, for better or worse, the US is reported upon so much that, you know, and these pictures come into our homes all the time. And I think it's only natural for us to have a reaction about that and to just feel desperately sorry for the people over there. And like you say, this thing just keeps happening. I mean, that Batman shooting was only a few months ago. And like I said, there's been 16 other mass shootings in the US this year alone, which I think is actually unusual. I don't think there's normally that many. I think that's a particularly high number this year for some reason. But yeah, we get the coverage all the time, and you know, I guess it's inevitable that we're gonna
yeah, no, sorry, I didn't mean to try to shut down the debate. I just sort of want to acknowledge that it's really difficult because, you know, it's your natural response. Well, it's my natural response. Obviously, the first one is sorrow and you know, and sympathy. But then, you know, how can we make sure it never happens again? You want to help.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So there were a couple of other things we were going to try and talk about. We've probably got another few minutes left. I promised myself I wasn't going to refer to how long we've got left in future podcasts because I edited some stuff last week and then I had to edit out me talking about how long things had gone on for.
Do you know the strategy we use on the PC Pro podcast is we write down everything we plan to say in advance and then we run through it, and then when we've reached the bottom, we stop. And some of our podcasts are half an hour and some are an hour and a half because it's just entirely fluid.
Yeah, and some of them involve playing a rather obscure version of Monopoly, I seem to recall, from a few weeks ago, which was quite interesting. For people who don't know,
it was a commemorative edition of Monopoly that had been put out by Bletchley Park, commemorating the life of Alan Turing. Obviously, in case you don't know, he's a code breaker and one of the grandfathers of modern computing. It was instrumental in breaking the Enigma code, which helped us win the Second World War, and sadly took his own life after being convicted of the heinous crime of homosexuality. So he's certainly an interesting character and one who deserves to be remembered for several reasons. And yes, so we played a game of Monopoly where we all travelled around a board that was marked with places and oddly things from his life. And I don't know if you've ever played the game Monopoly. It takes a little while. It's quite a slow mover.
Yeah. It's slightly distracting from the main discussion.
No, indeed.
Yeah. But actually also, there was a very interesting edition of Infinite Monkey Cage. I think it might have been the same week as that, actually, from Radio 4, where they were talking all about Bletchley Park. And there's some fascinating insights there. Anyway, we've got completely off track here. What we were going to talk about was Maria Miller's expenses. That was going to be the next thing. Emma, do you want to just briefly go over what your understanding of this story is?
As I understand it, what she's done is her parents moved into her London home to help her with childcare. She then claimed that as her second home, claimed £90,000, I think it is, on expenses, and that designated her constituency home as her first home, thus gaining quite a lot of money from the place where her parents live. And as I understand it, this is very similar to what happened to Tony McNulty, the former Labour MP, who was, you know, done for it, and not done in the courts, but, you know, paid back a lot of money. And yeah, the circumstances are very, very similar. So Maria Miller is currently trying to ride this out and see whether she can keep her job as Cabinet Minister for Culture, which she then managed to absolutely muddy the waters by having one of her, well, she didn't, but her special advisor and one of Cameron's senior press people decided to speak to the newspaper who were reporting on it, The Telegraph, and say, oh, by the way, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, she's the one looking at Leveson at the moment. You don't want to mess with her.
Yeah, it was almost like a kind of, nice newspaper you got here. Show you if anything should happen to it.
Yeah.
which is like
on mafia protection money. So yeah, that was good politicking there. Well done. Well done, Maria Miller.
I'm always baffled when these things come out because, I mean, to me, you know, to the man in the street, it just seems so obviously not only wrong, but you're in a job where you rely on your appearance, on your reputation. You need people to re-elect you. You need people to like and respect you to advance in your career. I mean, I just cannot imagine living in a kind of environment where, as I must assume, where this kind of thing is perceived as normal and uncontroversial. But if it's not, then I can't explain why seems to happen so much.
I think in this case, I think it's almost slightly unfair on Maria Miller because, yeah, I agree actually what she did was wrong. But I wonder why this has come out now, because she actually stopped claiming this in, I think it was April 2009, just before the previous expenses scandal blew up. So is it just that it's only just been discovered that
she's
done this
now? Well, the Telegraph had the files since forever. So I suspect what they've done is they've got lots and lots of stories on people that they're holding back until those people reach the cabinet or those people in a particularly politically senior position. They went with the first tranche, got lots and lots of people, lots of Labour ministers, lots of Conservative people with duck houses and moats. But they've still got some stories in their back pocket. And they're just keeping them behind for when they will be the most advantageous to release them.
It's interesting. I didn't actually realise from the headlines and synopses I'd seen that this was an old story. And in a way, it does kind of make it a little bit more understandable. If there was a culture back then, that it seems there was more of an anything-goes approach to expenses, which obviously got shut down quite effectively a couple of years ago. But then it's easier at least to understand why she might have thought, assuming you know that she perceived it as the wrong thing to do, that it was a case of everyone's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, she hasn't actually admitted it was the wrong thing to do. She came up with a really strangely worded statement about that didn't really admit or deny anything. But I think it's pretty clear that she must have seen the way the wind was blowing and decided, oh, I better not do this. This might look a bit dodgy. Didn't stop her from doing it for a few years, you know, running up to that. But do we need a moratorium on this? Are we going to keep finding every few months that the Telegraph pulls out another file from somewhere and fingers another cabinet minister as soon as someone gets promoted?
Why wouldn't the Telegraph do that? See, I'd rather see it all come out and be public. But yeah, if I were the editor of the Telegraph, I would certainly be keeping stories on people who might be rising stars back a bit to see how it goes.
I think that's sensible, obviously, from the Telegraph's point of view. And also, as a layman, I would like to think that everybody in politics is thinking all the time, is it possible this thing I'm considering doing now might come out down the line when it could really affect my position?
No, but I think the problem here, Darren, is that what politicians will be wondering is, should I do this? Because the Telegraph might not like it, and then they might pull out this file they've got some dirt on me on and publish it, rather than necessarily taking decisions for the right reasons. So I think we're in a bit of an awkward position.
I tend to think, though,
that
if there is dirt on you, then that's on you, and I don't think you can sort of be worrying about whether you make friends or not with the Telegraph. The dirt's going to come out, or it should come out at some point.
The other interesting story this week was one of the Tory MPs, I think it was in today's Sunday Mirror, one of the Tory MPs who was most vocal about how gay marriage was terrible for the great and wonderful institution of marriage, and he's been having an affair for 11 years.
Who was that?
Bob Blackman.
Oh, really? Oh,
I've met him. Could have been you.
I was on LBC with him a few months ago, yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll bring things to a close there then in that case. So I'd just like to thank Emma for being on, as usual.
Thanks, Emma.
Merry Christmas to you too, and thanks very much, Darian, for being on. It's been great. It's been great, and great insight into various things, and also a first that we've had our first
yes,
pirate
well,
party member.
No,
on,
thank so you for having me on. It's been very entertaining. I don't know if it's been at all illuminating anything I've had to share, but I hope it's been interesting at least.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it has been. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us. And I'd also like to thank Kevin MacLeod at Computech.com for our theme music. We're going to be having a break for Christmas and New Year, so our next recording will be on Sunday the 6th of January in the new year, 2013, and we'll be releasing it the day after that, as usual. Bye.